If you fast periodically, will you live longer and weigh less?
Does insulin type matter if you're a diabetic?
What's the impact of ADHD on education?
And sudden death in patients with heart failure.
That's what we're talking about this week on PodMed, the weekly look at the medical headlines from Johns Hopkins, posted on July 7th, 2017. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang, professor of medicine at Johns Hopkins, president of the Texas Tech University Health Sciences Center in El Paso, where I'm also dean of the Paul L. Foster School of Medicine.
Rick, I think we should turn right to JAMA Internal Medicine. This idea of fasting and prolongation of human life has been out there, very popular for several years. There's also been some question about whether periodic fasting can be helpful with regard to weight loss. And so, now there's this study.
There is this idea of fasting, and particularly what are called alternate day fasting, has actually been promoted as a superior alternative to regular fasting for people that want to lose weight. They don't stop eating completely, but they reduce their calories significantly to 25 or 50% of what's the recommended caloric intake. And then on alternate days, they may go up to 125%. Is that superior to regular dieting, where we will restrict caloric intake by about 25%? This was a single center randomized trial of obese individuals, and their mean body mass index was about 34. And they were randomized to, again, this alternate day fasting, to a regular weight loss, or control. Control, where they told them not to change your caloric intake at all. And then they followed these individuals over a 12-month period. 6 months where they were in their weight loss phase, and 6 months in follow-up to see whether they retained it. When they looked at the individuals who participated in the alternate day fasting, first of all, it was not superior. They didn't lose more weight. They didn't maintain it any better. But more importantly, there was a higher dropout rate. About 40% really couldn't maintain that. When push came to shove, it wasn't an easy diet to maintain.
A little bit disappointing, of course, and some people suggesting that this fasting state is really helpful with regard to reducing inflammatory factors and this other data relative to longevity. So, what do we think?
Besides looking at weight, they also looked at lipid status. In the individuals that were participating in the alternate day fasting, their LDL cholesterol was actually higher. So no evidence that it's superior for weight reduction, and really no evidence to date that over the long term that it reduces inflammatory or cardiovascular risk.
The take home sounds like then don't try your alternate day fasting if you're trying to lose weight or improve your health.
It's certainly no better than a regular diet.
Okay, let's turn from here to JAMA Pediatrics. We reported a few weeks ago about the impact of ADHD on teenage drivers and their rate of accidents. Now this study takes a look at, what about educational attainment?
I'm sure that we mentioned before that about 1 in 20 people in the general population is affected by ADHD, or attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. And in the United States, this condition costs us about $32 billion in annual health and work-related costs. There is treatment, and the treatment usually is related to one of many types of medications. For children who get this, it certainly helps to decrease the impulsivity and increase their attention, but what are their educational and health outcomes? So this was addressed in a very large study conducted in Scotland, where they looked at school-age kids over a four-year period from 2009 to 2013, and they identified 750,000 kids. Which kids were taking medications for ADHD, and how did they do compared to their peers? They looked at things like, did they have special educational needs, and what was their academic attainment? How well did they do at school in terms of, did they attend? Were there a lot of absences, or were they excluded from school? And they actually looked at their unemployment rate after leaving school. Here's what they discovered. Even though the kids with ADHD were receiving medications, in general, they didn't do very well. They had a higher rate of absences from school, a higher rate of being excluded from school, a lower academic achievement. They were more likely to leave school before the age of 16, were more likely to be unemployed, and were more likely to require hospitalization. Very disconcerting.
Disconcerting, of course, because then what is the upside of ADHD medicines? Because ostensibly, that's supposed to be the thing that helps them stay in school and be able to achieve and pay attention.
Well, what this study does not do, it doesn't take a group of individuals with either mild, moderate, or severe ADHD and compare those with medications and those without medications. So I don't want to leave the impression that medications can't be helpful. What the study clearly shows, and this is an observational study, a population-based cohort study, that for kids that are treated with ADHD, we still have to be concerned because many times they don't have the same educational achievements as their counterparts, their peers.
Right. And so to me, at least, says, hey, there's got to be some other stuff going on here that we need to A, figure out, and B, then strategize on ways to overcome.
And in many of these individuals, they have comorbid conditions. Oftentimes, they have learning disabilities as well. So you're right. It's not a single entity. Oftentimes, there are other behavioral issues wrapped up in it as well.
Back to the drawing board. Let's turn from here to the New England Journal of Medicine. This one's actually kind of good news, I guess. It's taking a look at people with heart failure and saying, wow, guess what? The rate of sudden death has declined.
When you say good news and you hook up sudden death and heart failure, it sounds like, what's good news about that? But for many individuals with heart failure, they develop arrhythmias, irregular heart rhythms, that does result in sudden cardiac death. And one of the treatments has been shown to be effective in the past is the use of automatic internal cardiodefibrillators. Well, over the last 15 or 20 years, we've discovered there are a number of different medications that can improve survival. ACE inhibitors or ARBs, beta blockers. The question is, over the last 15 or 20 years, as we've both discover these medications and begun to implement them, how has that affected the risk of sudden cardiac death? These authors analyzed data from over 40,000 individuals that had heart failure due to reduced heart function. This is just how do people do that are receiving medications. And what they discovered is over this time period, the risk of sudden death declined by 44%. This is remarkable. And it shows what happens if you use evidence-based guidelines and it's applied to large populations. So as you said, this really is good news.
We are seeing more people with heart failure. So let's talk about their management and what you would do right now to try to achieve a result like one of these.
What's clear is the medications I've mentioned are effective in preventing or minimizing the risk of sudden cardiac death. Okay, we started putting in defibrillators before we were using all this advanced medical therapy. Now the real question is there really much of a benefit? Does the implantation of a defibrillator help? And if so, in which patients?
That's sort of interesting on the heels of that study on defibrillators last week in the same journal. Finally, let's turn to the Journal of the American Medical Association. A rather exhaustive look at different types of insulin in people with both type 1 and type 2 diabetes. That's two different studies.
Elizabeth, this follows up on a podcast we did just a couple weeks ago looking at a newer type of insulin, a long-acting insulin. We already have some long-acting insulins on the market, glargine being one of them. And when I say long-acting, its effects last for about 14 hours. And we reported a couple weeks ago that a newer, even longer-acting one called degludec was non-inferior to glargine in terms of preventing cardiovascular events. But there was a hint that with this longer-acting, there were fewer hypoglycemic episodes. Following up on that, there are two studies in which patients with either type 1 or type 2 diabetes were randomized to either glargine or to degludec. They looked at the incidence of hypoglycemia. So we try to get the hemoglobin A1C to near normal. The closer you do that, the more likely you are to cause hypoglycemia. Well, in these two studies, the use of degludec reduced the incidence of hypoglycemia in the type 1 diabetics by about 10% and in the type 2 diabetics by about 30%. That's great news for an insulin that has a longer half-life than what we're currently using, a flatter insulin action curve, and less variability.
Good news, of course, that we're honing in on the most effective insulin that we can. What about the cost of these things?
As is oftentimes the case when something new comes on the market, it's more expensive. And how much more expensive is it than glargine? Well, what I can compare is there are two types. There's what comes in the vial, and that's still unknown at this particular time. But if you compare the pre-filled syringes, it looks like it's probably in the neighborhood of about 50% higher than the current therapy. So the question is, should everybody be switching over to degludec? Well, for individuals that really are having issues with hypoglycemia on current therapy, I think the answer is it's probably a good choice. But in individuals who aren't, you really have to weigh, as you imply, whether the benefit outweighs the additional cost. And that's something we need to wrestle with, and our insurance company is going to wrestle with as well. Hopefully over the long term, the cost will come down as it does with all new medications.
Well, I guess if we take it in aggregate and if we're able to reduce hospitalizations secondary to hypoglycemia, it might argue for this newer insulin.
And certainly in high-risk individuals, again, those that have had one or multiple episodes of hypoglycemia, or those who were really trying to maintain very tight glucose control. I agree.
Okay. On that note, I'm going to talk about the weight loss and the fasting in JAMA Internal Medicine this week on the blog. That's a look at this week's medical headlines from Johns Hopkins. I'm Elizabeth Tracy.
And I'm Rick Lang. Y'all live well.